Well, if you're just tuning in to pick up tonight's guest, you're already an hour behind. We started him last hour, a little flip. We'll be back in a moment with Charles Ostman on Coast to Coast AM. Charles, remember when you were a kid, you probably played, or at least you heard about the game Stratego. Remember that?
Actually, no, but plug me in.
That was a game. It was not one of these high-tech games. It wasn't electronic. It was a board game. And every person had little pieces of military might. They were squares. They were red or blue.
Yeah, you know, this reminds me of a game called Risk, which I did play, actually.
It's pretty close to that.
Okay.
And,
sure.
And the goal, the mission was to capture the flag,
right?
And you could put little bombs around it and stuff. But you couldn't; your opponent couldn't see what the pieces were. So you know, he'd trounce down the board and he'd hit a piece, and he's supposed to take it. If he was stronger, perhaps a captain would take over from a scout, for example, and beat him. And you know, you want to take the piece of the art of the game was to find a flag and get rid of your opponent's pieces. But you know, so you didn't know where the flag was because you're looking at the back side of all these little pieces. I sometimes wonder if the world scenarios are like Stratego games, where they put their little flags all over the place and they're in charge of the game. They're in charge of the board. What do you think?
Well, it's a little bit simplistic is not the right word exactly, but today's world is so complex and so interwoven with private interest and sort of momentary nation state government figures and all sorts of other folks sort of mixed into the middle of it. It's really not possible to sort of boil it down to quite that level. I mean, I think back in an earlier time, that kind of a representation probably was closer to the mark.
Not anymore.
No. Heavens no. And really, I mean, again, you have to sort of look at this sort of multinational corporate conglomerate style of global resource management with various governments, some more savvy than others, knowing how to sort of work with this emergent network of different kinds of entities and, you know, position themselves to have the best advantage. But, I mean, it's a very different world than the more traditional kind of militaristic games of the past eras.
Where do you see the strength of the United States?
I think our number one commodity that we are so remarkably good at, and we better not lose it, is our capacity to invent and create new things. That's the one thing we've really got our hands on.
And you think that is over and above everybody else?
I think it always has been, at least as far as technology goes. But we'd better be careful, because if we lose that edge, then I think our economy is definitely toast. I mean, we're no longer going to be a big manufacturing company. Those days are gone.
Did you see where Chavez, by the way, in Venezuela now believes that the Ford and GM's auto plants are national assets? He said that today.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on how one wants to look at that. But, again, our biggest commodity, I mean, our country was founded, really, on the concept of ingenuity, a desire to be independent from sort of traditional box-like bureaucratic structures. Our whole thought process is kind of wrapped around we're the new paradigm. We can, you know, reinvent ourselves as we need to, and that's, you know, that's like the mainstream of how we exist. And yet, if you look at our educational processes, you know, the way that sort of the current generation X or Y kids are getting into school and what they're focusing on, I have kind of a iffy feeling in my gut that says, if, you know, I remember back in the 50s and 60s, since you mentioned that time period earlier, there was a time when being an engineer or being a scientist was really cool. That was the hip thing to do. People looked up to folks that were intelligent, that had, you know, really strong intellects, that could, you know, outsmart their opponents in a clever game or a demonstration of intelligence. And we still have people like that here. But, you know, the majority of them are actually coming from other countries. And they come to our schools and they, you know, use our educational
platform. And then they go.
And then they go back to their home countries and, you know, develop industries there. Somehow this message is not sinking in to a lot of the policymakers and decision makers here. It just, you know, I don't know exactly how to phrase this correctly, but this is the last thing that we have that we can really claim to have strong sort of ownership of, and we better figure out how to maintain that and encourage it, because this may be our last shot.
What do you believe the goal is of all these various individuals who want this total control. I mean, what's the bottom line here, Charles?
Well, in a sense, anytime you can have a more unified control mechanism, in a sense, you can kind of predict the future and maintain a future that is to one's liking or, you know, suits their particular maybe religious agenda, you know, whatever it might be.
All right.
But you have to start by knowing what all the risks are, or as many of the risks as possible, and you have to know what all the variables are, and then trying to trim those variables down to a manageable range of predictability. And that's, I think that's exactly what this amounts to. They see themselves as the, I don't know, ordained leaders of the world. They see more than the average person does. In their context, they see the world being overrun by populations growing out of control. They see resources being consumed in a pell-mell kind of way without too much concern for the impact on the planet. I mean, in some cases, I can kind of understand their logic, actually. Not, may not agree with their methods, but I do understand what, you know, kind of what they see. And so they
as long as they're the ones left over.
Well, right? Yes, indeed. Now, you know, this is such a tricky question to deal with because, I mean, obviously it taps into very complex moral and ethical issues and so on. And yet, in a certain kind of way, I can kind of understand how folks of that nature could come to the views they do. Because there's many parts of the world where people are just, how can I say this, they're very stuck in trying to, in a sense, retreat to an earlier time, a more fundamentalist approach to how they see life. And in many cases, especially in some parts of the world, the modern world is just so strange and disorienting and alien to their thought patterns and to their culture, they literally want to retract and simply go back to a kind of a 12th century way of looking at life. And I'm sorry, but, you know, in the future, in our 21st century realm that we're now sort of migrating towards, that may not work. In other words, these old traditional, very rigid structures that worked for thousands of years are going to fall further and further out of sync with a world that is changing at an ever faster pace. I think that is the real conflict we're looking at. And so some folks of the world order type see that process and say, well, you know, this is just how it is. Evolution is an unforgiving process. It always seeks out the more successful life form. And if the variations in the life form in question can't adapt or function, then they perish. I mean, that's a really simplistic way of looking at it, but that's the logic in a nutshell.
And do you believe that this group that is pushing for, and is it accurate to say pushing for a one-world government?
I'm not sure I follow that exact choice of words, but something like a more unified governmental system where everything's kind of homogenous, more or less. This whole idea of, you know, competing and I want to have this chunk of the planet and only I can have it and nobody else can, you know, that sort of sovereignty concept, I think, is fading to the background. You're going to see a much more collaborative, kind of like multinational corporations, only multinational sort of government structures, sort of. I mean, it's a rough comparison, but that's the trend I see.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's, I think we're right in the midst of it right now.
We're seeing it happen. Exactly right, yeah.
Let's get back now to the technology end of this, too, because
sure.
That has a big effect on this and the China technology of what they did up there in space. Russia seems to be fading away. I mean, so we're you know, and I think we may even have SDI technology.
Well, we have stuff up our sleeves, and some of it, of course, is not being publicly discussed. But, and in fact, one area that I will discuss, because it's been out in the public circulation for a long time, there is something called zero-time-of-flight weaponry, and lots of folks know about
zero-time-of-flight weaponry? What is that?
And what that means is, in traditional weapons, like a rocket, for instance, or an artillery shell, whatever it might be, you're trying to propel a physical object to get from point A to point B and then hopefully hit the actual thing you're shooting at. And to get a missile to hit a satellite 500 miles out, that's not a small task.
No,
that's
it's not. That's
pretty
good.
A pretty serious bit of technology. And as I said earlier, Chinese scientists and technicians are some of the best in the world. These are pretty bright folks. And once they get their mind wrapped around a concept, they will engineer a solution. There's no question about it. However, there's a different approach. And the different approach says, what if you could aim a beam of light or maybe a packet of particles at something where the time of flight, yes, there is a duration, but it's so small that it's seen as instantaneous. So in a sense, instead of shooting a device, You simply aim a ray of either light or particles at the thing, and presto, you
it's done instantly.
Yes, exactly so. So we were embarked on this back, back in the late 70s, early 80s. I saw a little bit of this at Los Alamos. I did work on something called the Antares Project, which has been publicly acknowledged over the years. It's a big laser, essentially, that could punch a hole through something. I won't say from how far out or exactly how it worked, but we actually showed it could work. So if we fast forward to current times, is there a lot of research and sort of a renewed interest in this kind of thing? Yes, absolutely. Will there be maybe space-borne platforms that are designed to seek out and neutralize something like a missile being shot at one of our satellites? I'll let that for the audience to ponder, but let's just say lots of folks are looking at this. And could there be, at some point in the future, maybe even some sort of collaborative effort? The Western nations, kind of like a unified defense program to make sure that something crazy doesn't happen and all of a sudden half the satellites of the world are darkened. You know, that I could see something like that possibly coming to pass. It's kind of sad, though, excuse me, to see such amounts of money and resource get poured into what could be a rather difficult sort of space militarization system that we might or might not really want to see. I mean, I absolutely would not want to see, for instance, nuclear bombs in orbit that could be dropped down upon anywhere. There's some really bad outcomes. But I think a defensive system would make a lot of sense, and I would certainly be in support of that.
How would we know that any particular country had nukes up there?
Well, actually, we can. Well, there are ways to determine this. We can at least know that there's something radioactive up there floating around. However, how would we actually know exactly what its purpose was and what it was being targeted towards? That's the thing that we don't know. And I think there's a lot to be said for this, but I make note of the fact that China had declared, you may recall this not too long ago, they wanted to put manned operations on the moon. They wanted to build a base there. Now, a lot of folks would say, well, great, they're doing science. Well, not so fast. The moon actually is the great weapon launching platform of all time, if one wants to look at it that way. In other words, one could look down upon the Earth and simply target anywhere, and within a matter of minutes or hours at most, there is not a spot in the planet that couldn't be attacked and without much warning. I think a lot of people recognize this, and I made really careful note of the fact that Bush, of course, said, oh, yes, we're also going to respond by putting a base in the moon. And now everybody's thinking about, okay, we're all going to go to the moon. Well, some folks are thinking, oh, this is great. We're going there for, science and as a launching platform to go to Mars. And those are all lovely things. But I think the reality is we're looking at the military side of this, and that's, I think, possibly part of what's coming up in the future.
What was the name of the Steven Seagal movie where Eric Bogosian was this wacko mad scientist, but he had the capability of confiscating and taking over a U.S. satellite that had this incredible weaponry ability to beam down and burn and destroy everything on the planet? Do you remember that one?
I remember that one.
I got to get the name of that. That was a great movie. He was on a train, and I can't remember it.
Yeah, I mean, there have been
maybe it was Under Siege. It could have been Under Siege.
There's a number of films that sort of depicted variations of the theme. Actually, one of the more recent Bond movies had a really interesting theme. It was a North Korean-sponsored project that could reflect sunlight down onto the ground and sort of fry things with a giant beam of sunlight. That was actually kind of a cool concept, because I think that's actually quite plausible. And it was a former East German sort of political type who had made millions doing gun running or something, and then he financed the North Koreans to do this project. I mean, it was kind of an interesting concept. I think there's a lot of things that could be said for...
I got it.
Yeah, for
it,
how...
It was called Under Siege 2,
okay.
Dark Territory, 1995.
Well, you are the maestro of moviedom. I'm sort of much less so, but I'm always open to new ideas. But the point being that I think the public has been sort of introduced to these ideas, over the years through various films. But the reality is, going back to what we were talking about a little while ago,
yeah,
if we don't take seriously at least a defensive approach to, A, hardening the satellite systems that we have, B, having more of them up there, kind of a distributed resource, using microsatellites and, a different way of approaching the problem, as it were, and having other alternative pathways to protect the infrastructure that we have, We're in a very vulnerable spot.
Absolutely. And we don't have the landline backups anymore then, as
well,
we were talking about?
Yes and no, but it's kind of a patchwork, and that's really one of the things I'm concerned about. Now, there is something called Internet 2, which is something that's been sort of quietly brewing in the background, and you'll see it poking up into the public sector before too long. And I think there's a lot of very smart folks who, you know, clearly got this, and so they're looking at different ways to facilitate multiple layers of redundancy, that kind of thing. But I think to not see our vulnerability in space as at least something to be looked at as important as, say, our Navy or, you know, other elements of the military, I think would be really missing the point. A lot to be said for this. But at the same time, could that interest in space also be to our advantage in a very peaceful way that would, in fact, maybe save our planet from ecological disaster and possibly provide new economic stimulus for us? Yes. And I think one of the ways to go is to look at space as a resource for energy. And, in fact, one of the slides I provided, shows an example of a space-borne solar platform. And this has been worked on for many, many years. Well, Paul Werbos is one of the real thinkers along these lines, has published a lot of papers, and then more recently, sure, Charles Schulz, who's also been a guest on your program as well, you know, very strongly supports this. I do, too. You know, for the cost, look at it this way. We've just burned through about $1 trillion with our mission in Iraq with no real definable outcome. Everybody's sort of wondering what's going to happen next, and who knows. For a fraction, let's say half of that, if that was spent on putting orbiting platforms that could beam down sunlight that was converted into a microwave and then into, you know, large array collectors on the ground, A, we could power our entire grid this way, or at least a good sizable portion of it. B, we could market this to other countries. C, we could have a collaborative space entity that would, in fact, enhance the security of our other satellite networks. I mean, there's a whole range of ways to look at this. So, I mean, I think that it's not so much are these terrible problems that can't be solved. It's more like reorganizing and taking a second look at the resources that we can apply, but in a different direction.
Okay, if how many years do you think we are ahead of the Chinese space-wise?
Not very.
Five?
Maybe.
Okay, let's say five.
Yeah.
If they this year, a few weeks ago, did their satellite knockout test, does that mean we did it in 2002 and didn't tell anybody?
Well, I'll tell you what we did back in the early 80s. We showed that we could target multiple reentry vehicle warheads, or MIRVs as they're called, quite a number of them, at the same time using our ground-based laser. And I won't say exactly how that was done because that may still be classified, but we did show it was workable.
There's a reason, Charles, that other nations are allowing us to do what we're doing in these various countries without slapping our hand. We wouldn't tolerate the Russians doing it. We help funnel millions of dollars, billions of dollars to the Mujahideen to take care of them.
Yes.
We wouldn't allow China to do it. There's a reason they're letting us do this. I think we have incredible technology. They know it. We're not publicizing it. And it's up there. It's there, and it's capable.
I think that we have a couple of aces up our sleeves, but I wouldn't be overly confident. I think it's extremely prudent to be keeping a very close eye on what's going on. Now, there's one area...
Of course, I agree with that, but I don't understand why they're not trying to stop us.
Well, this gets into a much dicier game, because after all, look, the entire global economy is sort of interconnected in an irreversible way, and everything's so interdependent upon every other aspect of this sort of real-time information-slash-economic process grid that you have to be extremely careful about how you try to isolate or determine where a pressure point is, and then sort of encapsulize and change it, et cetera. It's a much more of a systems dynamic problem than perhaps what you've seen in previous decades. So a different kind of calculus goes into figuring these things out.
Let's talk about the new ray gun that we've been testing. Get your reaction to that. And then next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for Charles Ostman before we have open lines the last hour. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. This is the last week to get the January issue of the After Dark newsletter, which is the predictions issue. You'll still be able to get the free old CD shows, Art Bell's interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin, when you subscribe to After Dark. But this week will be the end for the January issue for you. So take advantage of it. You can call 1-888-727-5505 to subscribe, or if you have a computer, You can do it that way at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Charles Ostman, our guest this hour. We'll take phone calls next hour with Charles. Charles, the new ray gun that's been tested, where it incurs incredible heat on people.
Yeah, it's basically just like taking a microwave oven, but a much larger one, and simply aiming it at somebody. That's basically what it amounts to. I mean, it's very simple, actually. It's a concept that's been around for a long time. It just happened to get funded in a more aggressive way, and I think Iraq may have sort of prompted a more fast track. But this is not a new concept. But, I mean, if it's effective, it's a non-lethal weapon, one of many. But there's a more interesting area of projected microwave that I think might be kind of a really futuristic concept that's coming to pass. There's something called psychotronic weaponry, which suggests that thoughts can be manipulated or behaviors can be manipulated by microwaves, or let's just say encoded messages within the microwave transmission. And this has been going for some time. People always thought, oh, gosh, this is...
I hear voices.
Yes, exactly right. And, oh, this is just craziness, you know, some conspiracy nut. Well, not so fast. China, Russia, various countries in Europe, a whole bunch of folks have been testing this sort of thing for quite some time. And the ability to perfect that process is actually much closer than people realize. In fact, there is even Senator Kucinich was trying to come up with some kind of a law or a treaty that might put a ban or some kind of control on psychotronic weapons. I mean, the UN has discussed this. There's been lots of papers published on this. And the basic concept is, could people be instigated to say things or do things or maybe momentarily have moments of hysteria or, you know, psychological disarray, as it were? That's exactly what's coming around the corner. So even though this current sort of first-generation microwave weaponry is a very, you know, crude but effective way to simply make somebody feel uncomfortable from a given distance, I think the next generation is going to be a much more interesting, if that's the right word for it, and potentially really, really a new territory of weaponry, as it were.
Are we making a Manchurian candidate out of people?
Not quite, but certainly, I mean, I think in the general context, people are looking at a way to either momentarily or in some context alter the behavior of, let's say, a commander in the field or an elite team was being sent in to do some special task, and all of a sudden they got blasted with some kind of behavior-modifying weaponry that changed their thoughts, their perceptions, and it would be like instantaneous psychosis or something. That could be a very interesting weapon, and a lot of people would see some real value in that. Now, there have been further experiments where people really do hear voices, and in fact, it's been shown this can be done.
Like the ray gun, though, Charles, why don't we get like 10 units? I guess you can hit them from 500 meters away, so 1,500 feet, basically. Set them up along borders, like Iran, around Syria, to keep them from coming into the country. Just turn them on.
I think that's partly what's probably in the future. I think people are looking at these ideas. I mean, here's what I was going to propose as per the last few comments we were making. The days of big population-intensive armies in the field, lots of boots on the ground, with sort of traditional military protocols, those days are really fading into the past. Now, at some point in the future, if we end up really getting into an all-out confrontation with China, and I hope that doesn't happen, I don't think it really has to happen. Some people think it might. Okay, that might come to play.
You do think it might?
I think there's a possibility. I think that in...
Over Taiwan.
Taiwan would be one of the trigger points. But I think that everybody, and you know, look, the Chinese people are not stupid. They very, very much understand long-term chess as a kind of a global strategy concept. So they'll make threats. They'll do sword rattling. They'll try to call their markers in on the debts that we've already been committed to. You know, I mean, they have economic tools they can work with. They don't need to use arms. But they'll obviously have lots of military force, you know, the big stick that they can kind of shake over us. And
well,
say,
on the other hand, we'll be partners.
Well, that's what we're looking at. Now, but back to the original question. I think the concept of using I'm not sure smarter is the right word, but ever more sort of exotic weaponry to replace the functionality of lots of boots on the ground, that's exactly where we're trying to go. And many other entities throughout the world are sort of seeing the same idea, whether it's artificial intelligence, you know, smart vehicles, autonomous, you know, vehicles that can fly and drive around the ground, machines that can act as sort of military robots in the field, in parallel with other kinds of weaponry or deterrence systems that, just like you're saying, could surround a nation or limit the sort of movements of people through a certain region, that kind of stuff. That's absolutely what's on the drawing board, no question about it.
Scary.
Well, it's scary, but it's also
necessary.
Kind of a sign, it's sort of necessary. It's kind of a sign of the times. I'd rather see that process deployed than something much more crude and clumsy like lots of big bombs and a nuclear mushroom cloud. In other words, these are all sort of terrible potential outcomes, but you have to sort of pick the lesser of evils if you're looking at something that has no other option.
Well, I agree with that. You know, maybe that's the way it's going to end up.
I mean, here's a different way of looking at it. This whole concept of asymmetrical warfare, that really is where things are heading in the future. I mean, the attack of 9/11 was a kind of an introduction, if you will, to that concept on a large scale. But one thing I will say, if we don't use all the resources that we can, and by that I mean our inventiveness and our cleverness with high tech and an ability to actually deploy these things when the mindset is there, to, in a sense, protect our sovereign nation state, our borders, our ports, our satellites, you know, every aspect of what makes this country function as a country, if we choose not to invest in and maintain and continuously upgrade those capacities, all bets are off. And that's why I feel so strongly about having wandered into this Iraq debacle without really having thought out what the end game was going to be, but at the same time almost completely sort of abandoning, or so it appears, a lot of the security issues that are here at home. That's a logic flaw, which I personally have difficulty trying to understand, but it's a very serious one. And so when I talk about some of these more exotic weapon platforms, or at least deterrence platforms, it's really not in any way to suggest we should be more aggressive or cause harm or anything like this whatsoever. I'm just saying we should look at defensive options that are available and utilize them so that we don't have to have lots of troops out there in different parts of the world, but we can really concentrate on protecting our interests here and our people here.
Now, we talked earlier about Russia, and they just seem to be gone. Where are they in this picture?
Actually, they're sort of there, but not in an obvious way. Their mission right now is to control a lot of chaos that's happening within their own country. They have lots of different things to worry about. Crime is on the rise. They have organized crime on a scale you couldn't begin to believe by Western standards. Chechnya is still a very big issue with them. I mean, they've got all kinds of really strange and bizarre sort of socio-political problems, and they're trying their best to sort of keep things under wraps. But at the same time, they are marketing their best people and their best weaponry to the clients that can afford it. And, of course, their number one client happens to be China, which, of course, is why they were so interested in doing these joint war games. And I'm sure you've probably seen some news about this. Excuse me, gosh. Now, to say that Russia is out of the game, I think, would be really
naive.
Not. Yes, I want to use that word carefully because I didn't mean to suggest ignorance. I'm just saying it's not exactly how it appears. They're playing a careful game. They're making money. They're trying to enhance their interactions with China. They're trying to keep their military technologies alive, and they see a lot of value in space. Interesting enough, if they can market low-cost delivery to suborbital and orbital ranges of space for all kinds of purposes, they're very eager to sort of see that come to pass. And what's interesting is I remember when Bob Bigelow was on with Art Bell not too long ago talking about his private space program, which I think is really excellent. I think it's a marvelous concept, and I thoroughly give him 2 thumbs up for this. He made a very, very good point. He said, look, if we don't get up to speed and modernize our delivery capacity, that is the ability to get stuff off the ground into orbit,
right,
other folks are going to step right in, and they're going to really take advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Russia knows this. They're not dumb. They're getting it loud and clear. And I could certainly see a collaboration where China and Russia sort of put their best minds together and really sort of come up with next-generation delivery platforms and sort of take over, if you will, the commoditization of space delivery. You know, we again, need to take a second, third, and fourth look at this and decide what's our direction and how are we going to interact with this process in the future.
Charles, what about the privatization of space? What if we have these corporations that, on their own, launch, on their own have SDI capabilities, on their own attack other nations. Is that possible?
I don't know about attack other nations, but I absolutely agree with the first 2 points. I think that's actually where it's going, and that's kind of why I made this point. Because I tend to hold the belief, and I'm sure others will argue, and I'm happy to debate either way, but I think the days of big, top-down, monolithic, you know, very box-like bureaucratic structures to control things like access to space or, you know, the sort of big-ticket items of that nature, those days are kind of fading away. I mean, in an odd kind of way, the failure of Ford is sort of like a microcosm of that concept. In order to function in this sort of emergent world, I think it requires much more adaptability, being able to sort of reconfigure on the fly, kind of a process morphology in real time, as it were, and the ability to understand what your options are and deploy them in a way that's much more systems-oriented as opposed to sort of a narrowly defined agenda. And, you know, in past times, you can look at decades out, and we're going to go from this box to that box as our bureaucratic process dictates. That kind of stuff doesn't work so well anymore. So I think you will, in fact, will see a composite of private and public ventures with a kind of an industrial approach to how they're going to commoditize space for entertainment and travel and industrial processes, like there's a lot of biotech interest materials. I mean, there's a whole range of things that can be done today, but I think the big ticket's going to be in energy. And I think any number of private companies who might want to link up with various cooperative nation states to get solar platforms into space, maybe get other kinds of industrial machinery into space that could produce exotic materials at a lower cost and that sort of thing. I think there's a lot of potential for this, and the private sector absolutely will play a big role, no question about it.
Did you see today where Richard Branson, who's almost into everything, is now going to establish a stem cell bank? That's what he's going to do.
Yeah, no, I think this is exactly right. It's not only incredible, it's the way it should be. I mean, not to get too philosophical, but I find it extremely troubling, that is putting it mildly, when here in the United States of America, of all places, we have medical research and things like climate research and so forth suddenly being censored, and in some cases for, you know, religious reasons and so forth. This is just astonishing. Folks, this is the 21st century. We have to get real and look at reality for what it is and work with what we have. So if the private sector can say, hey, look, we can do it better, faster, cheaper, with more options, and if the governments want to, you know, be partners with us, great, but, you know, we'll do it ourselves if we have to, that's the way it probably should be, because that's what seems to be working.
That is. It's something. And it just seems to be happening faster and faster. 2007, you're going to the Global Clean Tech Conference.
I co-chair it.
Oh,
so
very good.
I get to be sort of, I don't want to say God for a day, you know, minor deity for a day. but it's a lot of fun because, you know, for many, many years, I've worked in the sort of venture capital world, sort of like a bridge between a lot of the laboratories and people that get financed and actually facilitating some finance along those lines. And so I get to see a lot of things that are sort of not yet public, you know, known, but I get to see them as they're in process. And there's a lot of interesting stuff which I think really could change the fabric of our future. And these conferences that I co-chair are designed to bring these things before the eyes of investors and policymakers and people who are actually looking at a very proactive approach to how we shape our not only our, you know, environment and various industries, but even our geopolitical status. So, I mean, that's actually why I do this, and it's a very good place to be.
Well, I got to tell you, it's happening, it's exciting, and, you know, on one hand, as frustrating as it is on this planet, I'm glad we're alive.
Well, as the Chinese would say, not to be too paradoxical, these are interesting times. And one sort of minor thought, if I might, since you mentioned Branson and Virgin Galactic, a different example of one which is very telling. You might remember when the Human Genome Project was the big topic du jour of the day. And you had Francis Collin on the government side, as it were, and you had Craig Venter on the private side with Cilantrix. And he said, look, I can do it faster. I can do it for less. You know, Francis Collin's world was, you know, big grants, big universities, 12 to 15 years, X billions of dollars. And Craig Venter said, you know, I'll do it in 3 years and for half a billion. Well, they were both right in their own sort of way. They had very different approaches. And what happened was a sort of a competition. And so something in the middle emerged. Craig Venter, you know, eventually, you know, made his first successful example. He made his millions off of various patents that came out of that process. And, of course, NIH, the people who were financing Francis Collins, you know, realized they had to sort of change some aspects of their sort of bureaucratic approach to these kinds of problems. But that was a very, very good example, the positive side, if you will, of how the private versus public sector can come up with different solutions to a complex problem, find up a sort of a middle ground, and eventually, you know, real solutions come out the other end. I'm saying, why can't that same approach be applied to energy, to space, to collaborative defense? I mean, there's a whole range of things that could be seen the same way. I think it's a model worthy of note and probably will be de facto standard for the future.
Well, fascinating. You know, the push toward all of this is, of course, based on, I think, too, what we're doing in the university level, the schools. How far behind are we? Because I'm going to start off by saying that. How far behind are we than other nations?
It's scary. That's the one area I really do feel trepidation about. You know, the realms of machinery, science, engineering, technical things that could have technical solutions to solve certain kinds of problems. I can sit and talk shop all day long. But when it comes to educational policy and how the process is actually functioning, and then you compare our sort of baseline standards with other parts of the world, this is where we're really falling short. And so going back one more time to that $1 trillion plus that we sort of sank into Iraq, if even a fraction of that was spent on a radical approach to how we offer more options to the educational process, and I'm talking starting with middle school, high school, et cetera, we need a much more diverse array of options to present to different communities and different cultures, if you will, so that they can choose and find the best solution that fits their educational interest and where they can excel and where they can be passionate about what they're learning. I think the problem that we're seeing in our educational system, if I can be so bold, is that we're still stuck in a kind of a mid-50s kind of big bureaucracy, you know, one-size-fits-all megalithic approach. That's not going to work. I think we need to really radically look at our educational process and kind of get back to basics and really focus on excellence as being something to be desired, as something to be cherished. I'm not sure how to exactly do this, but I certainly understand the problem.
Do you believe wars will be fought over water, drinking water?
I think water is the next big crucial challenge, and I say this for a very specific set of reasons. One can always invent new kinds of energy solutions, you know, whether it's biofuels to run your cars or solar platforms for a power grid or just whatever it might be. But you can't replace water. Water is the one thing that you either have it or you don't have it. And the global climate is changing radically. Now, some people may say it's because of greenhouse gases. I think it's partially because of that. I think we're also observing some very strange activities with the sun, which
I agree with that.
A lot of people, I mean, well, I live just right next door to the SSL Space Sciences Lab. In fact, I even rent part of my house out to a visiting professor who's working at the lab now as he speaks, so I get like a daily dose of what's happening with their research. And they're really concerned. I mean, they don't know. They're witnessing some very strange behaviors, and they're saying, well, you know, there's some new science emerging here. And I'm going, yeah, that's interesting. But meanwhile, the planet is being, you know, cooked. So, you know, a lot of people are debating, you know, is it a political thing? Is it science? Is it something in between? That's probably something in between. But one thing is for sure, the planet is changing. So how we adapt to this and how we decide to partition or regulate access to fresh water and how it's utilized in the future, that really will be the next big challenge. There's no question about it.
All right, stay with us. Phone calls next with our guest Charles Ostman. And then the last hour, I've got open lines plus an interview with the mother of microbiologist Dan Burrish. That's all ahead on Coast to Coast AM.